A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Matt.
And Sean.
From Two Black Guys.
With good credit. From a local business to a global corporation.
Partnering with Bank of America gives your operation access to exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful you'll make every move matter.
Visit bankofamerica.com/banking for business to learn more.
What would you like the power to do? Bank of America, N.A., copyright 2024.
Hi, this is Imran Ahmed, founder and CEO of The Business of Fashion. Welcome to the BOF podcast. It's Friday, March 8th, and it's time for our seasonal review of the fashion season that was. Several newly appointed creative directors, including Sean McGeer at Alexander McQueen, Adrian Appiolazza at Moschino, and Ximena Kamali at Chloe, debuted at their respective houses, while recurring motifs of sci-fi and elevated everyday clothes were a response to anxiety about the current state of the world.
There's that incipient sense of apocalypse lurking. And I think if you step back and take a really long view of what was happening, you could feel that kind of anxiety.
As always, I sat down with our editor-at-large, Tim Blanks, to discuss our highlights and key takeaways from the fashion month gone by. Here's Tim Blanks on the BOF podcast.
Well, hello, Tim. We have parted ways. I am in Dubai. You're still in Paris. But due to popular demand, we must do our annual or biannual wrap-up of the collections and the season that was. Looking back on the season, Tim, anything salient for you that emerged as a theme of what designers were trying to say and get across in their collections?
There were a couple of things that I feel were veiled responses to what's happening in the world. I don't think anybody was overt with their statements. I think people were more explicit about the emotional impact of what's happening on their work. Early on, I detected this rather peculiar strain of sci-fi, I thought. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, oh, that's just me. You know, I'm just seeing things, making things up to suit some fantasia of my own. But the Vuitton show last night was full sci-fi. And it just made me think about science fiction's relationship to the real world, traditional relationship to the real world, and how it's traditionally a venue where writers and filmmakers and musicians and whoever else question reality. I don't know. Maybe that's probably too much of a stretch. But I did feel Dune 2 is the biggest movie in the world at the moment. There's that incipient sense of apocalypse lurking. And I think if you step back and take a really long view of what was happening, you could feel that kind of anxiety.
Anxiety, yeah. You know, we're clearly not living through a period of like prosperity or clarity around the state of the world at the moment. So that, and then there's a whole environmental collapse. So there's this general state of anxiety in the world about like, what does the future hold?
And upcoming elections everywhere.
Exactly. Something like 2.5 billion people will go to the polls this year all around the world. I mean, people have already voted in places like Taiwan and Indonesia. But, you know, the U.S. election was looming large in conversations, particularly with the Americans, but also with everybody, because whoever gets elected in the U.S. later this year, that's going to impact the way of the world for the 4 years after that.
And I think, obviously, that has the fashion industry thinking about where it sits. It's vastly different from the world that existed even a year ago. And I guess it just goes to prove once again that John Lennon was ever prescient when he said, life is what happens when you're making plans. I hope that's what he said.
Or something like that. But that definitely holds true, because I think in the post-COVID world, I think everyone was planning for a rebound and the Roaring 20s part 2. And all of those plans have been put to a halt, because actually, although there was like a big surge in our industry towards the end of COVID as people did that YOLO phenomenon, you only live once. I think as Luca Tsoukas put it, you know, people decided, rich people particularly decided they'd rather die poor than not spend their money while they're alive. So we've seen that resurgence, but there is a big pall cast over the world given what's happening, you know, on a variety of fronts, as we just discussed. And maybe that's a reflection of this sci-fi focus, because you can kind of take yourself, transport yourself to another reality. I'm really sad I missed that Vuitton show, because, you know, I watched it on my phone last night from here in Dubai, and it reminded me a little of those amazing Balenciaga shows that Gesquiere did back in the day that I was never allowed into because they would never give me a ticket because it's the early days. But yeah, talk to me a bit more about that show. It looked pretty incredible.
I think the impact of the show was established with the incredible set that Philippe Perrenot designed. He's the artist who's been working with Nicolas Gesquiere for a while now. In fact, ever since he started working with Gesquiere, I think Louis Vuitton has progressed by leaps and bounds. But one of his things he does is he, in his art, is he makes these huge, big marquee-like structures. And the one he made last night was sort of housed this enormous, enormous like mothership thing that had little satellites, and they looked like they were communicating vaguely. But the thing that blew my mind was over the top of the structure, there were lights moving, there was sound roaring, like there were things flying over us and looking at us. It sounded a bit like helicopters, but you realize it was probably much more futuristic. So,
like surveillance?
Whatever it was, whatever he'd created up there, this noise would roar over your head and a spotlight would kind of score the darkness in front of you. What it reminded me of was a movie I saw recently two or three times called The Creator, which the American military has developed this amazing sort of destructive machine that travels over the landscape, and it casts this curtain of light. And that's what this is. I was getting that, you know, it kind of reminded me of that. And then the clothes came out and there was, that's a bit Dune, and that's a bit kind of Queen of Outer Space. And that's a bit, you know, there was that side of Gesquiere's personality as a designer where things maybe looked a bit like neoprene, and there was a lot of white and a lot of reflection, a lot of shiny stuff. I mean, they could have been heading off to a space station. And the sound was insane. The sound was just, it makes you want to go home and open a nightclub in your living room. Nicolas Gesquiere has always talked about sci-fi. I mean, from the very beginning, I think the first interview I ever did with him, it wasn't actually sci-fi, it was horror we were talking about. But he's got a very, very acute interest in those genre outings. And last night was definitely the pinnacle of that interest.
So apart from the sci-fi observation, Tim, was there another way creatively that you saw designers responding to the state of the world at the moment?
I think what you said before about the darkness, the sort of somber quality that we saw in a number of collections, and then also this other thing, which has been in fashion for a while, the elevation of the ordinary, the elevation of the everyday. The glib formula is finding the extraordinary in the ordinary, which, you know, is a noble endeavor at the best of times. But we saw a few shows, thinking especially of Undercover, where Wim Wenders wrote a remarkable poem about a working woman and a single mother raising her 8-year-old child in a big Western city and going through the minutiae of a day in her life in the most exquisite detail.
Watching a working woman. As always, she wakes up just before the alarm goes off. As always, she looks at the clock and smiles, but then turns it off before it would start ringing. She doesn't want her child to wake up, not yet.
Everything she did suddenly became important just from the way it was listed, and also the way all these activities, the mundane things in her day, fitted into her world and made this network that totally sustained her. And, you know, at night she would put her son to bed and she'd go to curl up and read one of her favorite thrillers by Raymond Chandler or Dashiell Hammett. Every detail was just so beautiful and evocative. And then Jun Takahashi showed the collection to go with that. everyday clothes, but completely transmogrified by his insane ingenuity, where we were looking at things that look like layers of clothing that were actually one piece. Interestingly enough, Chitose Abe at Sakai had exactly the same idea, where you're looking at something that looks like jackets and coats and things layered, and it's one easy piece. I mean, I'm a real sucker for stuff like that. But you have look at Bottega Veneta as well, where Mathieu Blaisier was also talking about making the ordinary extraordinary.
I was just going to say, like you, I found that so moving. Like just the little details. The part that really struck me was like the things that she would do to protect her son and his sleep. So like when she was waking up in the morning, she would go into the bathroom and she would close the door before turning on the light. There were a few details like that where you could see she sounded like a single mother raising this young boy on her own. And so like everything that she was doing was about thinking of him first. I thought that was just quite beautiful.
And having the dinner at night with the one candle and having their movie night. Oh, it really was.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
It was absolutely beautiful. And also Wim Wenders has just made this film Perfect Day about the toilet cleaner in Tokyo.
Yeah, and he's done that, by the way, Tim, in collaboration with Koji Yanai, who's the son of the founder of Uniqlo, Tadashi Yanai. And it's all started with the idea of that Tokyo toilet project that we talked about at Voices in November 2022. So I've heard that movie is beautiful, but I haven't seen it yet.
Well, that inspired Jun to approach them to write a poem for this. I thought that was such a lovely collaboration. That was a very, very uplifting moment in the season, I thought.
Absolutely. Okay,
yeah, well, the rain drove down.
For those of you who weren't on the ground in Milan and Paris, this was probably the worst weather of any fashion season ever, because it basically rained every single day in Milan and Paris. And it was so cold. And if the sun came up for like an hour, it felt like a bit of a luxury, but it was pretty miserable. I mean, rain and protection of the rain, or from the rain rather, was a big theme that came through at Burberry this season. And I'm curious, Tim, to hear your thoughts and reflections on Daniel Lee's third outing for Burberry, which seems like ages ago now, but it was the most anticipated moment of the week in London. I think people have been looking for a more clear proposition from Daniel on the runway. You know, his brand idea about like showing the breadth of the Burberry brand is pretty clear, but how that connects to what's on the runway hasn't been so clear. So what was your take for this season?
Well, what does Burberry mean to most people? Love it or leave it, Burberry means a trench coat to most people. For all the efforts to make Burberry into an expensive luxury brand that can compete with the Diors and the Vuittons of the world. We've certainly read enough about how that exercise is having slightly ambiguous results. And then this collection was, I thought, very much about what does Burberry mean to people. It means outerwear and boots. And it was a solid commercial collection on that level, playing to the strengths of the house and maybe doing away with some of the more outre fashion flourishes that have been introduced by various creative directors there. You know, the Burberry blue that Daniel was trying to make the signature color for Burberry, the way he made that green the signature color for Bottega Veneta when he was there. I thought mercifully there was no blue in this collection, because that blue just never really sat with me particularly well.
I quite like that blue. You know, I quite like the distinctiveness of that blue. And I think lots of brands are trying to own these colors now. So like even Sabato at Gucci, what we'll get to in a moment, has trying to own that kind of ox blood red color. Whether that strategy of owning a color is enough of a creative direction for a house, I think a lot of people would have things to say about that. But I quite like that blue.
Well, I thought it was quite telling that the Burberry color scheme this time was moss and mud, the colors of stomping around in the woods in the Highlands.
Quite a lot of people felt like this was the closest thing Daniel had done to the heyday of Burberry under Christopher Bailey, and some of the casting you know, in your review, I remember you said something about the Lilies, Donaldson and Cole, and, you know, like the, some of the Edie Campbell. It was like all of these models that were like
the Campbells, Edie and Jean.
Exactly. Like the, I don't know if Jean Campbell was around during the time of Christopher Bailey, but like there was the casting and there was like the focus on outerwear. Maybe there wasn't the joy of those Burberry collections that, you know, when the confetti used to rain from the sky in Kensington Gardens, but like it seemed more aligned with that Burberry where the real focus was on these, like, you know, Christopher Bailey would do a different version of that trench coat every season, you know, in some kind of creative flurry of color.
Well, you know, they're both Yorkshire boys, aren't yeah. they? Christopher Bailey and Daniel Lee are both Yorkshire boys. They're both born within Cooey of the Burberry Trench factory. I think Christopher had a much more charming intuition about Englishness, and he focused on the sort of eccentricity of Englishness and the, you know, the David Hockney-ness of Englishness and the David Hicks-ness. And Daniel Lee is a, you know, he loves contemporary dance. He loves kind of wilder, more untamed things, maybe.
And he likes this kind of less aspirational side of British or English culture. So he opens like these pop-ups in like, I don't know if they were like sausage or pasty shops, but there's this like kind of like more gritty side of English culture that, as Vikram on our team keeps reminding me, is not what American or Chinese luxury customers think about when they think about England. They think about, you know, all the pomp and circumstance and the, you know, the royal family and like the more like glossier, richer side of English culture. But yeah, I guess, you know, I think the general consensus was it was a step in the right direction, but I guess we still have to wait and see how that resonates in the stores. Moving over to Milan, the designer that both you and I really, really love, who sadly wasn't able to show his Y Project collection this season in Paris, still made a pretty triumphant effort at Diesel. Do you want to talk to us about your thoughts on that collection and what's happening there with Glenn Martens at Diesel?
Well, I've been saying this for a while. I think he's a genius. He can work, he also is able to work in a number of different areas. You know, he proved he could do haute couture with his collection for Jean-Paul Gaultier. Y Project is a sort of right on the edge of fashion avant-garde-y, and Diesel is this gigantic denim project, which he wraps in this fabulous narrative each time. I think it might have been the first show I saw of the whole 2.5 weeks of shows.
Well, you saw Burberry before.
Yeah, in London, but I'm speaking about Milan and Paris. I think it was the first show I saw in Milan, and instantly I was getting this Diamond Dogs, you know, the David Bowie sci-fi wannabe pop opera that never happened. And he does post-apocalyptic better than anybody. But this time, I think he also brought in a lot of really quite classic references and the technical capabilities of that brand. You know, it's like some when you go to a Xenia show with Alessandro Sartori and you see the fabrics in a Xenia show and you can't quite fathom what they are. That Diesel has that same effect on me. You're kind of marveling at the ingenuity of what they're showing there. There's also a lot of technical window dressing for the whole thing. That the fact that they had 1,000 people streaming in live from around the world, so the video walls, and obviously you're waiting for somebody to do something ridiculous. There was so much weird stuff going on. There was an alien, and there was a sort of somebody who looked like they'd escaped from the cast of The Hills Have Eyes. There were drag queens, and I was waiting for somebody to kick off, but nobody did. You know, there was such a huge and motley collection of people. Glenn talks about the democracy of Diesel and kind of lives that. And I love how offhand he is, too. That's another thing, that he's so humble.
Yeah. I had a coffee with him in Paris afterwards just to, like, catch up and maybe get a bit of an understanding of, you know, what his plans are for Y Project, and stay tuned for more on that later.
But there's a whole wave of these guys, like Glenn Martens and Casey Cadwallader and Nicola De Felice at Courage, that you feel they're the future and you're waiting for the future to happen. That's how I feel about them all. They're all so good and all so different and all so passionate about what they do.
Yeah, it feels like you could kind of see who the next generation of big time creative directors will be at some of these houses when there is a changing of the guard. You mentioned Nicola De Felice at Courage. I also thought that the, you didn't come to the show, but the Rabanne show by Julien Dossena was like, I think the best show he's ever done. So there is this like next generation coming up. And Glenn's certainly one of the kind of guys I would be eyeing if I was an Arno or a Pino, you know, trying to plan the shifting tides over there. There are some empty slots there, and there's no shortage of speculation and gossip about who's going to end up at Givenchy and some of these other houses where there's, you know, rumored to be some changes coming. So there's a good pack of talent to look at, for sure. Speaking of debuts, there was a new designer, Adrian Appiolazza, at Moschino. And as someone who attended those early, very first Moschino days, Moschino shows rather, in Milan back in the day, your review said you felt like his debut was very faithful to like the pure codes of Moschino.
Yeah, he got it. He really got it. Admittedly, he did tick every box. If you detailed Franco Moschino's iconography, Adrian Appiolazza went down the list and ticked every box, but it was such a joyful show. I think that that was probably the most joyful show of the whole season. It was just such a happy show, and that wasn't always the case with Franco Moschino's shows because, you know, his shows were so ironic and so satirical and often very spiky that you wouldn't walk away saying they were
joyful.
They were joyful. But I think that's not to say that Adrian reduced anything. He didn't. I think he celebrated the work of the man in such a way that I'm really looking forward to seeing what he does next.
Well, I guess he's going to have to go beyond a reissuing of like pure Moschino codes, right? He's going to have to bring a bit of his own voice. I don't think he had much time to do this collection, given that sadly David Rennie, who was the designer who was originally appointed to take over from Jeremy Scott, passed away suddenly. So give him a bit more time and let's see what he can do. The other brand that we have to talk about for Milan is the Gucci outing from Sabato De Sarno. This was his third outing as well. He's done one women's show, which was not well received by the critics, yourself included, one men's show. And this was his second women's wear outing, his third show for the brand. Do you think there's a focus or clarity coming through about what Sabato wants to bring to Gucci and one that marries up with the stated business strategy of Kering, which is to elevate the brand, elevate it to a more luxury offering, make it a bit more of a timeless interpretation of Gucci rather than one that's, you know, like the one with Alessandro Michele was so specifically linked to that moment and that designer's aesthetic world?
Well, I think there's a focus for sure.
How would you describe it?
Focused.
Focused on what?
Focus. Focused on focus. It's very single-minded and I'm just waiting for a sort of a breakout moment.
Yeah, I think that's the general consensus. I went into the Via Monte Napoleone store just to see what that vision felt like in the retail space. I don't think every brand needs to completely change its stores every time it appoints a new creative director. In fact, I think that's economically and financially not a viable strategy. But I think, you know, it just felt like I was walking into a space that was still waiting for a vision. I did speak to a couple of retail associates who had both been at Gucci in that Via Monte Napoleone store for quite some time. And they said that the early signals from the product arriving from Sabato's first collection was that it's selling. And there, you know, in particular, we talked about a couple of handbags, his reissuance of the Jackie bag, which is now made of higher quality and lined with leather, not lined with like a fabric. and an old Tom Ford bag, and I can't remember what it's called, but it's kind of this oblong, long shape with some big hardware. And both of those bags seem to be performing well. So I think, at least from a commercial standpoint, the jury's still out on how the brand is going to perform. But I think I agree with your perspective that we're still waiting for that breakout moment.
Well, I think you said it there, like the Jackie bag and the Tom Ford bag doing well, but we need the Sabato bag.
Exactly. So let's see what plays out there. The other brand in the Kering group that's of note in Milan is Bottega Veneta. You briefly mentioned it earlier. That show, again, was one of my absolute favorites in Milan because it just feels like all of the different elements that make a great show just really come together. In a way, it's the polar opposite of what I felt at Sabato De Sarno's Gucci show, which is like the set, the music, the styling, the location, the overall vibe, like it all clicks and you understand that there's someone really thoughtfully thinking about how all of these things make for an expression of what that brand stands for. Of course, what he's been exploring and diving into is this idea of like craftsmanship and how do you take innovation and bring it into the, you know, what that brand has been known for a really long time.
We'll be right back with more on the BOF podcast.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero. If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move. By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America NA, copyright 2024.
Have you ever owned something that inspired you to up your game? For me, I got a chef-grade range recently, and now I'm cooking new things every single night. Seriously, no cuisine is off limits. The point is, when we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. I can picture myself with a car full of groceries, cruising down the highway, soaking up the sun with the available dynamic Sky Panorama glass roof. Ugh, pure bliss. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
You know that's the sound of another sale on your online Shopify store. But did you know Shopify powers selling in person too? That's right. Shopify is the sound of selling everywhere. Online, in-store, on social media, and beyond. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/BOF, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/BOF to take your retail business to the next level today. Shopify.com/BOF.
So the other big debuts that are really notable this season were the McQueen show by Sean McGeer and The Chloe Show by Ximena Kamali. I think very highly anticipated shows because on the McQueen side, this Sean was the first, really the first designer or creative director to come into that house who has nothing to do with the past at McQueen, who didn't work under Lee McQueen himself. And at Chloe, you had a new designer come in who has a real connection to the history of Chloe, having worked there twice before in the past and has like a real affinity for that brand. And there's been kind of like a number of different designers cycling in and out of that brand. And, you know, I'm curious to hear what you think about McQueen and Chloe and how those debuts landed.
I think that the challenge with McQueen is that the only people who've ever been in charge of that house were him and Sarah Burton, his trusted lieutenant, who has nursed that legacy so beautifully and made McQueen a byword for exquisite craft and a real sort of romantic spirit in fashion. I think Sean, being a young, gritty Irishman, wanted to go back to the roots of McQueen. His reference points were two of the earliest collections, Banshee and The Birds. And if anybody remembers those shows, the shows in those days were rough. They were raw. They weren't the astonishing spectacles that they became much later in his career and then also under Sarah Burton. In fact, a very close friend of Lee's pointed out that in those days, the clothes that he made himself were perfect because he was such an incredible tailor, but the rest of it, not so. And Sean McGuire got absolutely pilloried after his show by that mob of people who sit out there in the ether. And I think all they want to hear is really, really bad things, because if you write a good review of something, they come in their hordes for you. I mean, I loved that somebody said my review was worse than the show. Makes me kind of laugh. But I suppose that's testament to the way people feel invested in McQueen. I think he's the greatest designer of the last, I don't know, 30 years. And I guess there's a lot of other people who feel like that too. And so Sean is an invidious position taking up that mantle. But in going back to that, the beginnings of Lee McQueen himself, he established a connection that I think is really promising for that house. He isn't into the romance and the exquisite storytelling so much as he's into the rough, tough, sort of iconoclastic side of McQueen. And I really liked a lot about his collection. People were hammering away about the tailoring. He had 2 months to put that together. He started on December the 1st. So in 2 months, I think he did a pretty good job. And there were things, and you know, people, one of the things that was always so strong about Lee McQueen was, we talked about dark elements at the beginning, but he could bring in some really dark elements into his collection. There's some weirdness and some heavily fetishistic things, like bring in some very twisted notions. I think this is what Sean McGuire is also quite interested in as well. And even though at the end he showed three dresses that were sort of, he called them car dresses. They were made out of metal. They were just showpieces. People, of course, went to town on them.
But you know what, Tim? I think that as a creative director debuting at a house, it's much harder to create new energy than it is to create merchandisable clothes. And I think that's what he succeeded in doing, is he created like a new energy around that brand. Because, you know, this the Sarah Burton version of that brand had become, as you said, a beautiful interpretation of the softer, more feminine side of McQueen, but Sean is really leaning into this like harder edge. And you really felt that in that show. And like, yeah, maybe there needs to be more substantial work done on the actual collection. And there needs to be more things that people can actually buy. And the tailoring and the execution needs to be a little bit sharper. But I think it was like a really great start, because I felt like I understood kind of the energy he wants to bring, which is what's missing in some of the other things.
Yeah, you know, that like the smashed windscreen dress,
yeah,
and t-shirt. Things like that felt pure McQueen in a funny way. Showing the cars at the end was like J.G. Ballard. You know, like McQueen, he might reference a photographer like Joel Peter Witkin or reference Kubrick's The Shining. His references were never particularly consoling references. And I feel Sean McGuire has really cut from that cloth. And again, as I said with Adrian Apiolozza at Moschino, it's going to be interesting to see what happens there. Really interesting. I mean, I'm really keen to see what the next step is.
I think one thing Sean might want to think about is showing his collection in London. It feels to me like the energy that he was trying to capture by shipping us all out to like the outskirts of Paris maybe would be received better in the context of London Fashion Week. And God, could London Fashion Week get a boost from having like McQueen showing back in London? But it feels to me like that would also help to like clarify. If that's what he's trying to lean into, is that gritty side of McQueen, then maybe showing in London would help to like underscore that message a bit.
Yeah, anybody who remembers the McQueen shows in the Gatliff Road Depot in Victoria was in familiar territory with that venue from the other night show.
And how about Shamina at Chloe?
I sat there thinking there aren't clothes like this around anywhere else. And I thought that's a really, really good place to be in for her with what she wanted to say with Chloe. She, again, going back to the roots, she went back to Karl Lagerfeld. She picked one Vogue shoot of a Chloe collection by Karl Lagerfeld from 1977 and elaborated on that shoot. And I remember that shoot in 1977 when I was flicking through my French Vogue at the age of 3. It's one of those things that stays with people. That's where she started. And I thought, wow, never mind that I totally identified with that starting point. But I thought that she did that so well. And also, as you said, she'd worked for Phoebe Philo and she'd worked for Claire Wake Keller at Chloe. She had two perspectives on the Chloe girl. She loved Karl Lagerfeld's work there. She's saturated in the history of the house. So it wasn't an iconoclast coming in to completely turn everything upside down. But in a funny way, by making the statement she made, she did kind of turn Chloe upside down a little bit. Considering what's been happening at the house over the last while, it was a real charge. And the minute Kate Bush starts on the soundtrack and with cloud busting, and you know that there's going to be this surge of really strong female energy. And that's what she did.
I agree. And I think the other thing that was really such a pleasant surprise is I hadn't met Shamina before. So the first time I met her was backstage and then later in the evening at dinner. And then a couple nights later, we were seated at a dinner together. And she's just got this quite infectious energy about her. And it's so nice to have someone who brings this like really positive, like she's a very charismatic person. And I think you could see her really becoming, you know, embodying the new Chloe and being that kind of ambassador for Chloe in a way that maybe some of the more recent creative directors never were really able to do. Like she's just such a vivacious, energetic, charismatic individual, which is really important these days in a creative director, someone who's able to engage with the customer and like become a face for the house in a way.
Yeah, I would agree. I'd add charisma. And again, we can run through that list, Glenn, Casey, Nicolas, Julien, they're charismatic people. It's interesting judging the LVMH awards and seeing how those little personal and tangible things can make a real difference when you're talking to a designer about their work. Charisma is a little more powerful than that.
I think the real challenge for Shamina at Chloe will boil down to what she can do with handbags. I was sitting with the CEO at Chloe who joined in December, Laurent, and he was really, really thoughtful about what he's planning to do now that they've got this new energy at Chloe. I do believe a big part of the success of this business is going to rely on like these three or four handbags really landing with customers. You could see a lot of the women at the dinner wearing that bracelet bag. Those bags aren't going to be available till later in the year, I think in June. So like, I think the real test comes now to see, can Shamina do her version of the Paddington bag that was such a hit when Phoebe was there, you know, and Claire Waite Keller had some quite successful bags as well. So that'll be a really interesting thing to watch in coming seasons. We should talk about Rick Owens, right, Tim?
Yeah.
I mean, what a beautiful moment.
Yeah, that actually, there you go. There was a response to what's happening in the world. He did say barbarism is unleashed, and he just felt like going home and showing, and he showed in his house, his remarkable house, and showed a beautiful collection. It was funny. It was because he called the collection Porterville. He always has great names for his shows, but Porterville was the town he was born in California, the town where bigotry and bullying and intolerance shaped his young personality, made him the renegade that he is today. So it was a sort of Barb thank you to Porterville for making him what he is. And also the whole idea of going home, I think, was important to him. I love the fact that he's finally settled in Paris. He's reconciled himself to the fact that Paris is where he will live out his days, that in that house. So that, and that it already has a sort of Pharaoh's tomb atmosphere about it slightly. So Porterville's the womb and Paris is the tomb. And I thought that was a wonderful cyclical kind of thing there. And part of the commitment is he's finally learning French. And the first thing he learned, appropriately enough, given the climactic conditions we were enduring, was, what was it? I don't see the need for umbrellas. A raincoat with a hood is good enough for me. That was the French he'd mastered after weeks of immersion.
So he learned the word parapluie, I guess.
Parapluie, yes. And ça suffit.
I think that's such a nice moment there. I, everyone who's listening, you have to watch the interview that Tim did with Rick as part of our new Backstage Pass video series that we did this season, because the thing that I found so moving in listening to Rick talk about his response to Porterville is that it seeded his life mission, which is fighting for aesthetic, enabling people who want to express themselves in different ways to feel accepted, to feel included. It was such a beautiful message. And it's like a 3-minute.
Inclusivity.
Yeah.
Like I just said, charisma. I mean, is there anyone more charismatic than Rick Owens in fashion? I mean, when he talks, you want to sit cross-legged at his feet and just listen to him all day long. He speaks in the most lucid, complete thoughts, long, never rambles, just kind of gets where he's going, but a very, very cultured person. So, thank God we've got Rick Owens in the world.
A designer that's able to communicate clearly what their thought process is, what their creative process is so important. And I wanted to touch briefly on the preview you had with Demna before the Balenciaga show, because, you know, in your review, you called it the art of the preview, because like Rick, he's one of these people who's so clearly able to explain the idea.
Well, yeah, I go to a lot of previews, you know, they serve a purpose. But his was really like a performance. I mean, we started here, we ended there, and in between, he very articulately and very concisely explained some of the ideas that he was going to show in the collection. I think he's come through quite a dark personal time himself, and he was very keen to stress that he was in a much, much better place, and he'd got rid of a lot of the toxic elements in his life. And he's just a hugely entertaining person. It was so interesting just watching him do the job. You know, I have a job to do here, and these people are going to be here for half an hour, and the next lot are coming in, and next person's coming in half an hour, whatever. Bang, out the door. But personal, engaged, yeah, that's why I call it the art of the preview. And then the collection was that show, good Lord.
Well, the only moment of sun that we had during the entire season.
And Demna,
I don't know how he does this, but he like manages to pull out these moments. Like he couldn't have known the weather was going to be so atrocious. So we stepped in from the kind of cloudy, rainy, cold Parisian landscape into this sun-drenched space that was all screens. And the illusion felt real, and it was remarkable. It was remarkable. I actually felt better seeing the sun creep across the walls. I love that.
That's how people are going to live underground in the future, with a digital sun kind of creeping up their walls all day long.
I mean, I have to say, fake sun is better than no sun, because I actually felt better sitting in that space. It didn't feel like we were sitting in a box, you know, which effectively we were. It felt like we were in like this beautiful...
Well, you didn't have to take your shirt off. Everybody told you it wasn't real sunlight.
True. And then the collection, do you think Demna's managing to carve out something new and like move away from the aesthetic of Balenciaga that has, to a lot of people, become a bit dated? Did you feel like it was a step forward?
I felt like it was, because it came from a happy place, it's very persuasive, but I'm not so sure it stepped a long way away from the aesthetic he's established at Balenciaga. I think that he's a very, very astute designer. He's very, and another very ingenious designer. But fashion's like everything else. Fashion's like music. Fashion's like art. Everybody has their moment, and then you maybe lull, and then maybe the moment comes again. So I think to be looking for a renaissance is probably not the right thing to be looking for. I mean, there have been so many wonderful designers who never, ever, their work never, ever dropped in quality, who have just been backseated and then being reassessed or not. And I thought everything about that show was kind of vintage Demna. It was definitely the same designer who did everything that we saw and loved when he first started at Balenciaga. I would say, though, that the video wall, when the show started and those walls of those concrete panels we were staring at turned into this video spectacular, there was a progression in that, which I felt ended up somewhere not so cheerful. You know, from the landscapes, the wonderful natural landscapes and mountains and lakes and forests, and then it all got a bit glitchy, and then it got really glitchy, and then it became like a TikTok hell. it all kind of dissolved into this at the end. There was this forest that looked like it had been completely blitzed out in a nuclear exchange, a forest of pixels, and then it was static. And just that static to me is that kind of hiss and sizzle and that blankness. That's when you're living underground and the digital sun goes out.
Yeah.
And you're left facing the madness of that.
Yeah.
And he still has that strand of thought running. That's another reason why I love him, what he does, and why I love him. But
it ends. All of a sudden, there's no second walkthrough. The room goes dark. And the applause and the reaction to that show this time was something unlike we normally hear at shows anymore, because usually there's a walkthrough and everyone's on their phone. But like, there was quite a response. So he still manages to create a moment. Okay, Tim, we're almost out of time, but the Prada and Miu Miu shows, they really resonated with you this season. And you say Miu Miu Prada is your hero of the season. Like, why?
Yeah, because she does it again. Both those shows, very, very different shows. I mean, she said yesterday that Miu Miu is her, which she's said a lot before. Miu Miu is very true to her. And also, she thinks of Miu Miu as being a non-fashion statement and Prada as being, you know, much more of a fashion statement. And because Miu Miu is her, it's not about fashion, because she doesn't consider herself to be a designer. Like Rick Owens, I find them eternally interesting people. Because they have eternally interesting interests. They, when you have a conversation with her, it's hardly ever the usual conversation about the collection or clothes or whatever. We ended up talking about what she says. She isn't showing pieces of clothing; she's showing pieces of life. So her catwalk was populated with quite a cross section of ages and genders and so on yesterday, and I just think the way she does clothes without, I mean, Miu Miu for the last few seasons has been a mega fashion statement, it seems to me. There would be a lot of people who would question her, saying she's not a designer and she doesn't do fashion, because it's been one of the, Miu Miu's been one of the most influential fashion statements of the past few years. And this show went back to a more sort of gentle her, maybe. I felt her a lot more than what the way Miu Miu's been looking. But she's there and she's doing it. And it's I found the Miu Miu show very reassuring, I have to say. And it was, I'm glad, you know, on the last day that there was that element just to have a final conversation with her and feel a little bit better about the world, maybe, even though we don't really feel better about the world, and we do talk about that, but just the fact that we can talk about it not feeling better about the world makes me feel better about the world. So there's my final paradox for the season.
All right. Well, Tim, as always, a pleasure, and always grateful for your perspectives and having this dialogue with you. And I know so many people look forward to this every season, so I hope we've lived up to your expectations. And that this will be the source of new ideas and provoke some thoughts and ideas of your own. And if you have questions or comments, please send them to us or leave some comments on Instagram or tell us what you think in the post on Instagram or LinkedIn or wherever you follow BOF. So thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Imran.
I wish you a safe trip back to London today. And I look forward to seeing you in person again very soon.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The BOF podcast is edited and produced by Emma Clark and Eric Bria in the BOF studio team.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.